He's going to be talking about the Colonel Report, I believe it's called, and he'll be telling us everything that's been happening and what's going to be happening with the Linux kernel. So, Jonathan, the stage is yours.
Thank you. Well, I am John, and this is the Colonel Report. Here's what I'm going to do. The talk comes in three parts. I'll start with a quick review of how the kernel development process works, because in my experience, there are a lot of people who still don't really have a handle on it. I'm not sure I have a handle on it, but I can talk about it anyway. And talk about a couple of the issues that are pressing on kernel development now. Then I'll do a very quick recent history review, just sort of saying how we got to where we are now. And then I'll try to spend most of the talk looking forward and kind of waving my hands and guessing about what might be coming in the near future with the kernel. I'll warn you that it's going to be fast because this is a tight time slot, and if I run into Trish's time, somebody's probably going to haul me off the stage. So, the way the kernel release process works anymore. There is a major kernel release about every 3 months. They'd like to do a little sooner, but about 3 months is how it works. They're called 2.6. whatever, with point releases for important fixes like that. The thing to remember is that every single one of these 2.6.x releases is a major release. It has new features, it has internal API changes, it breaks all your binary drivers, it will do all kinds of things that, that you would expect from a major new release. This is a big change from how things were done a few years ago when the major releases came a few years apart. People still ask me, they really do, when will the 2.7 kernel be out? And the answer really seems to be never. The way things are going, people are happy with it. There doesn't seem to be any need, any change coming that is so disruptive that it would require the creation of a separate long-lived development series. Linus the other day, yesterday, said that it would really only happen when someone comes along and pries the kernel out of his fingers. So, no 2.7. It's going to be 2.6. whatever for the foreseeable future. Well, yeah, the microkernel process might require 2.7, but I don't see that on the horizon this year anyway. I'll come back next year and we'll talk about that. Okay, the life cycle of a kernel development process in these sort of three-month processes starts at what I call week zero, when what's called the merge window opens. This is when Linus says, okay, the kernel is fair game. If you've got big changes and they're at a point where they are ready for inclusion into the mainline, then send them to me. And they all get shoved into the kernel over the course of about 2 weeks. The rate of patching at that point is pretty well impressive. There can, in fact, be several thousand patches that go in over the course of about 2 weeks. So needless to say, that can destabilize things just a little bit at times. After 2 weeks, the whole thing gets packaged up. And what comes out is this 2.6.whatever-RC1, which is not really a release candidate, despite the naming of it. It's really just the first of a series of test kernels for the next major release. And it is, most importantly, the sign that the merge window has now closed, the disruptive changes, new features, are no longer welcome into the kernel. Now, every now and then, something still slips in, but that's pretty rare. And when it does happen anymore, it's generally regarded as a mistake after the fact. So discipline actually holds surprisingly well. If anybody remembers the old style Linus feature freezes back in, say, 2.1 or 2.3 or even 2.5, it's not like that anymore. When that window closes and the features freeze, it freezes pretty well. The patch rate stays high for a while just because there's obviously a lot of things to fix, a lot of things to polish up, a lot of details to take care of. But the patches are supposed to be fixes and completions and so on at this point. Over the course of the next, in theory, 6-8 weeks or so, we see these additional RC releases coming out at the rate of about one every week or so. Again, they are all supposed to be fixes on what was put into the first RC1 release. The patch rate slows as these bugs do get fixed and there are fewer things to fix. And as the kernel slowly approaches completion, you see the number of patches going down. And then by the program, in about week 8, the final 2.6.x release comes out. In practice, it tends to be closer to week 12 that this kernel comes out, and you got this nice, perfect final kernel, and the whole thing can start over again. for the curious, you are here. We are currently at 2620 RC5 at roughly week 7. I didn't actually count them. It's getting pretty close. There might be one more RC release, but within the next couple of weeks, I would expect to see 2620 come out in its final form. So I'm still showing this chart that I ripped off from Andrew a year ago. But it's a good chart in that it shows how this process works and how it has changed. What you're seeing here is just a cumulative count of the number of lines changed in the kernel against time over the course of a few years at this point. So you can see that the line is fairly steep, that we are changing a lot of lines of code in the kernel. You can see that it is not getting any smoother over time, that the rate of change continues to be high. The interesting thing you can see is as you get towards the end and this merge window technique was adopted, you can really see it working in the chart there. You see the almost vertical slope when that merge window opens and a large amount of flux goes into the kernel. Then the merge window closes, things are restricted to patches, and that line levels out pretty quickly. And it goes almost flat for a while until the kernel is released, and then it starts all over again. And this plot's a little bit old, but if you were to continue it to the current day, it would really look just the same sort of thing. It looks like a staircase anymore. So, end result of all this, got a very high patch flow rate, something that was really just inconceivable a few years ago. And this means that new features get through to users far more quickly than they ever would have in the old system. Back in the days of 2.1 or 2.3, 2.5, it was not all that uncommon for someone to code up a feature, get it into an early development kernel, and wait for 2 years or so before that showed up in an actual stable kernel release in the mainline kernel. That's a long time to wait for new stuff to get through and actually get into widespread deployment. And because it was such a long time to wait, distributors tended to backport all of this stuff into their kernels. If you looked at some of the 2.4 kernels that certain distributors were shipping, these were really 2.6 kernels in disguise with the 2.4 number on them. They were these sort of Frankenstein things that they had patched together in ways that nobody had ever really anticipated would be done. We've gotten away from that. The distributor kernels that you see now are much, much closer to the mainline than they ever were before. It's a much better situation. Kernel releases are predictable. I can tell you we're going to have one within about 2 weeks or so. If you have something that didn't get in, it's going to be in 2.6.21. I say we'll wait till around May, something like that, you will have it. That was never, ever the case before. No one knew when they were actually coming out. And the bottom line of all this is that for the most part, users are happy, developers are happy, distributors are happy. The system works much better than it did once upon a time. But I say most of the time because there are issues that have come up, and one that still comes around every now and then, perhaps started in a more formal form last May when Andrew Morton got up and he said, I think the 2.6 kernel is getting buggier. We are adding bugs to the kernel more quickly than we are taking them out. And that, of course, is not a good path to be on. Other people have echoed this criticism. They say that the new development model places such an emphasis on getting new features and disruptive changes into the kernel that there's no longer any time for stabilization. And so we are slowly squandering our reputation for reliability for putting out solid kernels. And this is not a good thing. So if you're concerned about this, there are a couple of questions that you have to ask. Is there really a problem? And if so, what do you do about it? I don't really have time to get into the first question. You'll have to trust me when I say that it's really hard to demonstrate whether the kernel is becoming more or less reliable over time. There are just a lot of variables that go into it. You can't really answer that in a definitive way. The second question, in a sense, is easier because whether or not you think there is a problem, I have yet to find anybody who would argue against the idea of fewer bugs in the kernel. So it's worth thinking about what you can do to make it better, regardless of whether you think there are problems or not. And people have been thinking about it. It starts with the obvious stuff, like more testing. Getting people to test kernels is still hard for a lot of reasons. There is a really nice aspect of free software being the free beer aspect of it. You don't pay for it. But in my opinion, part of the payment that you really have to make for good free software is to be part of the development process in testing things, if nothing else. If you can find a problem and report it, it will get fixed and it won't bite other people. Otherwise not. So we've always got to get more people testing kernels. That's sort of an ongoing challenge. When people do test kernels and they report bugs, How do you track it? The kernel actually still doesn't really have a centralized bug tracking system. There's a Bugzilla run at kernel.org or at OSDL that contains a few of them. Distributors have their own bug trackers. There's some work going into trying to unify these bug databases somewhat, but there still is no central place for kernel bugs, and there's no person whose job it is to track kernel bugs. This needs to improve. There's talk occasionally of trying to get a kernel bug master, and I hear rumors that it may happen, but I've been hearing those for a while, so I don't know. Something still needs to be done. We do have an energetic kernel developer now who is tracking regressions in the current kernel releases, and this is good. I find his list always to be suspiciously short, but it's a good step in the right direction of tracking things that are broken in the current development cycle so that they can be fixed before that kernel goes out. Once you have your bugs reported and tracked, you still got to fix them. This is actually harder than you might expect for a lot of reasons. Fixing kernel bugs is a hard, hard problem, because often the developers who can fix it don't have the hardware, they don't have the workloads that can actually cause this bug to happen. So they can't reproduce it. So you end up in these cycles where the developer has to say, excuse me, could you try this and see what happens? And then the person says, it still crashes. And this can be kind of painful if the other person's at the other end of a modem about 10 time zones away. And so this process stretches out over a long period of time, and it's not uncommon for one side or the other to just drop it, get fed up, not deal with it. So the end result is that you do get kernels that go out with known bugs in them because nobody has managed to fix them. Other things that can be done and are being done, making bugs harder to introduce in the first place. And there are a few ways of doing that. Just starting with better code review, which does happen some of the time at least. But one thing that you see happening a lot is the improvement of the internal kernel APIs to make it harder to create bugs in the first place. The kernel famously does not guarantee stable internal programming interfaces for any of the internal kernel calls. And as a result, you can change things. If there's an interface that causes bugs, you can fix it up so that it doesn't. So in 2.6.21, I think you will see a revamp of the timer interface within the kernel that adds a bunch of type safety to it, and which will make it harder to add certain kinds of bugs to the kernel. Something that we've been seeing a lot in recent years is much greater use of automated tools, getting the computer to do the job. Something that went in a release or two ago is the locking validator that looks at how parts of the kernel are acquiring and releasing locks, and it can find all kinds of potential problems like deadlocks that would almost never happen in the real world, except in some really critical application somewhere where no one's expecting it. And it can find them ahead of time and get them to be fixed. There's a tool called Sparse, which is a static analysis tool. It can be used to find all kinds of bugs. Sparse actually has a real maintainer now. It's starting to be used outside of the kernel environment. So I think you'll see interesting things happening with Sparse and just going through and finding bugs before they ever actually bother somebody. The fault injection framework is going into 2.6.20. This is a mechanism for injecting certain kinds of errors, primarily memory allocation errors, into certain subsections of the kernel code. If you're a conscientious kernel developer, you of course check all of your memory allocation calls, and you do something if that call fails, and you try to recover gracefully. But those code paths are very hard to test. They almost never are tested because these calls almost never fail. You plug in the fault injection framework, and it will say make every 10th memory allocation within a certain module fail. And then you can actually see how the module responds and see what goes wrong. Does it clean up after itself properly? And fix your problems there. And that should do a lot to improve the robustness of parts of the kernel. Then there's a memory leak tracker patch out there. I don't know quite when that might go in. It actually uses techniques that are more often seen in garbage collectors to find all of the memory that's currently findable within the kernel and then tag the rest as leaks and actually point the finger at who leaked it. That's a useful tool as well that's coming around and getting into a more stable shape. Then the final idea that goes around is the creation of an occasional stabilization release, where people say, instead of adding a whole bunch of features into the next 2.6x release, let's just make this one a bug fix only release, and we'll make an extra stable kernel. This is really a hard sell. It's hard to get a critical mass of people who are willing to do this, so it doesn't happen. Linus has actually been heard to say that 2.6.20 is a stabilization release, that he was hoping to get it out quickly with all that. But if you look at some of the stuff that went into it, it doesn't really fly very well. It's not a stabilization release. I don't know if those are ever going to happen or not. But it's out there. People are working on it. moving on. Here's just a quick summary of how we got to where we are, saying with about a year ago, I used to actually do the entire 2-6 series, but this is not a 3-hour talk, so I can't do that anymore. But back to the beginning of January of last year is when 2615 came out, allegedly 15 years to the day after Linus bought his first computer that was used to develop Linux. This included hot plug memory support, which you can use as a way of dealing with, say, failing physical memory on a system or adding more, but the real use of this is actually in virtualization environments where you want to hot plug some virtual memory into a virtualized client that needs more for a while, pull it back out later on when it doesn't need it anymore. iSCSI for all the big storage people, and a thing called shared subtrees, which is a way of creating different views of the file system namespace for different processes or groups of processes on the system. You can do some very complex things with it. I've got an article on LWN if you're more interested in how to make that work. There's a lot to it. And by the way, you can imagine that if I boiled down 5,000 patches to 3 lines, I've left a few things out. These are just a few of the highlights that are there. 3 months later, 2616. And one of the things they did is they took out semaphores, which were one of the fundamental mutual exclusion mechanisms used within the kernel, and replaced them with a new thing called mutexes, which are a much safer interface to use, a much simpler one that doesn't have its own architecture-specific variant for every architecture supported by Linux. This is something that came out of the real-time tree, one of many things that came from there that helped to make the kernel better. Oracle's clustered file system went into 2616. This is just a way of running a cluster around a shared disk and having a coherent file system that is accessed by all of them. And then finally, batch mode scheduling, one of those things that people said would never actually go into the kernel because you couldn't do it safely, finally went into the kernel because Ingo Molnar figured out how to do it safely. 2617, last June, almost exactly 3 months later, included support for the Spark Niagara architecture, included a thing called lightweight robust futexes, which everybody should know what that means. Futexes being a mutual exclusion mechanism, a synchronization mechanism used in user space now. This helps to make threaded programs work in a better way. Again, this is work that came out of the real-time tree. User space software suspend, trying to move some of the suspend to disk mechanism into user space. This has been a little controversial. I don't think anybody's actually using it, but that was added there and created a big discussion of what really belongs in user space and what really doesn't, sort of relevant to this morning's talk. One of the more interesting changes, perhaps, was the addition of the Broadcom 43XX wireless driver. This is a reverse-engineered driver for a wireless chipset that, with an intransigent manufacturer. And it brought wireless support, native Linux wireless support, to a large group of users who never had it before. I'll come back to that. And the splice system call, which if you look into is very interesting, allows you to create I/O plumbing within the kernel. It's not used much, but I think it will be when people figure out some of the stuff that you can do with splice. Okay, last September, we had 2618. This included priority inheritance, actually code to eliminate priority inversion problems in especially real-time code. This came from the real-time tree. Another thing that Linus said would never ever go into his kernel, ever. But you set Ingo Molnar on a task. He'll figure out a way to make it work right. So he did that. They ripped out and redid the interrupt handling layer to make it much more generic and less architecture specific, more capable. Same was done with the core time subsystem. It's a long-standing patch that finally made it into 2618. The locking validator, which I have already mentioned. And the change that perhaps makes people most excited, not quite sure why, but Greg Kroah-Hartman had spent almost as much time trying to get DevFS out of the kernel as Richard Gooch originally put trying to get it into the kernel. He succeeded finally in 2618, and it is gone. Then our current kernel is 2619. That came out in November. One of the changes that you'll start seeing deployed more widely soon is the parallel ATA driver subsystem. This is a new way of driving what people still call IDE disks that will replace the rather crufty old IDE subsystem with a rather more rational current ATA, parallel ATA driver subsystem, and arguably a more rational maintainer. Uh-oh. There's another cluster file system, GFS2, which was acquired by Red Hat a while back. EXT4, which is a file system where a lot of development stuff will do. I'll be coming back to that momentarily. And EcryptFS, which allows for file-by-file encryption at the file system layer, went in 2.6.19. And that is where we are now. So that is my cue to start looking forward. So I have to put up my standard disclaimer slide because predictions are hard, especially when they involve the future. And even more so when they involve the Linux kernel for a number of reasons. We don't have any five-year roadmaps, as analysts are fond of pointing out to us. So we have a real disadvantage over from proprietary software users because they know exactly what they're going to get from their vendor and exactly when they're going to get it. We don't have that. We have to muddle by without. There's no ability to force work from anybody. You can write a roadmap and you can say this is our nice nifty carrier grade roadmap that is all the stuff we're going to have in the future, but you can't make anybody do it in general. It's only going to happen if somebody or some company, somebody's boss, causes it to happen. But more importantly, there are no limits on the imagination of what people can do. So things will come from far afield and nobody's going to say, excuse me, that's not in the roadmap, we can't put that in. And that's, I think, one of the most important aspects of how we work. It really is. So it's hard, but I won't let it stop me. I'll wave my hands anyway, just basically by looking at what people are working on and what the pressures are from the outside world. But if you believe any of this, woe unto you. The first predictions are always the easiest ones to make. The 2.6.20 kernel, we know what's going to be in that at this point because the merge window is long closed. This will come out perhaps as early as next week if things go really well, otherwise not. So what's going into there? There's a whole lot of new drivers, as is usually the case. I can't really list them all here, but there is the USB vision driver, which will bring support to an awful lot of USB webcams, which were not supported by Linux until now. And lots of other stuff as well. The UDP Lite protocol, a version of UDP kind of suited to the needs of multimedia applications and all that. Find David Miller if you're curious about that, get him to tell you about it. Fault injection framework I talked about, relocatable kernel is something that the crash dump people wanted. A whole lot of internal API changes, a couple of which were quite disruptive and they involved changes to many hundreds of files and so on, break all your outside drivers, all the usual stuff. And then there are a couple of significant changes having to do with virtualization. So that's kind of my leaping off point for looking further ahead here at this point. Because virtualization, besides being, as Rusty put it, a great tool for extracting money from venture capitalists, is actually an area of interest and of use for a lot of reasons. You can do server consolidation, move your various tasks onto a smaller number of physical boxes, save space and power and all that. You can use it for the creation of high reliability systems. There are people doing things where you take virtualized guests and actually move them between physical systems transparently while they're running and people don't even notice. You can do fault isolation or just general isolation, security, sandboxing. There's a lot you can do with virtualization. It's a useful technique. So if you look at full virtualization or paravirtualization, there are a few big players out there. Xen is the one that has gotten a lot of hype over the years. Being a full paravirtualization solution, paravirtualization being that you define a machine architecture that's almost like the host architecture, but not quite. So you have to build a kernel that's meant for that architecture in particular, and you run that kernel. That's what Xen does. Okay, it's been out there for quite a while. It's extracted a lot of money from venture capitalists, but its path into the kernel has been rather slow for a lot of reasons, and I think there are reasons to suspect it might even get slower. We will see about that. User mode Linux has been in the kernel for a long time. This is a way of running a Linux kernel as a process on another Linux system. You can do a lot of cool things with that. And then a lot of commercial offerings, but I don't think I need to get into those. The biggest issue with all these virtualization solutions has been they all want support in the mainline Linux kernel, and they all want their own particular hypervisor interface put in. And that's just not going to go. The kernel developers might be persuaded to include one hypervisor interface that they could all use, but we're just never going to include half a dozen of them. So the good news is that we now have one. It's called Paravert Ops, and it has gone in for 2.6.20. This is a common interface. What they've done is they've just taken a number of very low-level operations that you might not want to let a virtualized guest do and wrapped them in functions that the kernel then calls. So you have a little function to set a page table entry or set a privilege register, that sort of thing. Then there's a little module that you can load in that will do this. There's one that does it on bare metal. So you just plug in the bare metal thing and you can run your kernel on just on the computer directly and it will actually do the operations you want to do. Or if you want to run under a specific hypervisor, you replace that thing, perhaps at boot time, with another version of it that instead of operating on the metal will nicely ask the hypervisor to do it for you. So this is the interface that has been adopted for hypervisor access. It's a very volatile interface, and since it's an internal kernel interface, it probably always will be. But it's still, its shape is still being determined. There are a lot of issues to be worked out there. But people are starting to use it. One of the hypervisors that has come along fairly recently is the Rusty Visor, which of course is a name he doesn't like. I think they call it Elgguest or something like that, but I don't ever hear anybody use that name. It's the Rusty Visor. It's a simple native virtualization mechanism. You load a module and you can create virtualized hosts, all that, and it uses Paravert Ops. I also saw just a few days ago a version of Xen that uses Paravert Ops. They just put that patch out not too long ago. So we're starting to see the hypervisors move over to the Paravert Ops mechanism. A separate development that went into 2.6.20, something that came up fairly recently, surprised people, is a thing called KVM, the Kernel Virtual Machine. This is full virtualization support for hardware, which has this feature, meaning the newer Intel and AMD processors, which actually can do virtualization in the hardware. So you can run a native kernel, you can run different operating systems without having to actually make the kernel deal with a hypervisor directly. So you just have your hypervisor open this dev KVM, and then you do IOCL calls to create virtual CPUs, to launch a kernel on them, and to do memory management and all the other things you need to do within a hypervisor. So as I said, this is a full virtualization solution, but people are doing paravirtualization with it as well. There was a patch that came out a week or so ago that uses paravirtualization to get rid of some of the things that are most expensive to do in a transparent way in the hypervisor, and get some really pretty impressive performance out of KVM doing that. So you'll see a lot happening with KVM in the future. If you're interested in virtualization, there are some talks that you can go to, one tomorrow on KExec for mostly debugging stuff, I think. There's Rusty and a bunch of other people representing some of the other virtualization projects that are talking on Friday. And then Peter Chubb has a paravirtualization talk on Friday as well. So if you're interested in this stuff, those are the places to be. But full virtualization is not the full story on this. There's another approach that's called containers. Containers are a much lighter weight approach to virtualization. Instead of actually emulating a processor and running a new kernel on it, what you really do is just create a set of walls around a set of processes on the existing kernel and then restrict their access to the outside so they think that they're running on a separate kernel, but they're not. The real difference with containers is that all containers run on the same kernel, whereas virtualized systems each have their own kernel. You get much better performance, but you can only run one kernel for all of them. So there's, as I said, a lot of work going on in this area. A number of projects that are working on this now, proprietary and free. Once again, they all want into the kernel, but nobody wants to have multiple implementations of this. The work that has to be done to make containers work right is non-trivial. You have to find every global resource that is in the kernel. Processes are global, devices are global. The system time is global. Every global resource that exists in the kernel has to have a little wrapper put around it to make it container specific. So doing this even once is a little bit of a hard sell. Doing it separately for every container project is impossible. So the container people have to get together and define a set of common interfaces for doing containers. And the good news is that they're doing this. And some of their work has already been put into the kernel. Other parts are still under development. But this is happening. The projects are talking to each other. None of them, however, are talking here, as far as I can tell. So I can't suggest any talks to go to about containers. Moving on. File systems are suffering from some interesting pressures right now. You may have noticed that disks are getting a little bit bigger in recent times, quite a bit bigger. They're doing it quickly, but they're getting faster at a much slower speed than they are getting bigger. The implication of this being the time it takes to read a full disk is growing, meaning, among other things, that the time it takes to run a file system checker on a full disk is growing. So you might ask how long it takes. Well, if you're running one of the RAID systems at kernel.org and it crashes and you have to run the file system checker, you're talking about a week. This is not the sort of uptime that people have in mind when they deploy RAID systems. It's just not. So things have to be done to deal with that sort of problem. Disks are not getting any more reliable. They're still cheap junk for the most part. And various limits on file systems are being reached. Essentially, our file systems are old, and it's my favorite sort of quotes being Andrew saying that we're nursing along our ancient file systems when we could build something new and exciting. But I think we're going to kind of keep nursing along the old ones for a while, as far as I can tell. Where most of the action appears to be at the moment is in a thing called ext4. This was essentially a version of ext3 that was forked off within the kernel. It is actually in the mainline kernel now. It's a development file system in that you can run it, you can put your data on it, but you're advised to have better than normal backups of it. It includes some new features now, things that have been under development for a while. Extents being a different way of representing how the blocks in a file are laid out. It's much better for larger disks and larger files. 48 bit block numbers finally went into the ext file system. This will get us over that pesky 8 terabyte limit that I know have been limiting many of us. It's been a problem with my kids' downloads. So there's a lot of other stuff that's happening there. Other areas we see, every now and then somebody pops up and say, I've got this great log structured file system. Look how fast you can write to it. Log structured file systems are very good for fast writes. They're not so good on reads because they just sort of go sequentially through the disk. So you see a lot of these bright idea log structured file systems that show up. They tend not to make it into the kernel for the most part. The exception that you might see in the near future has to do with file systems for flash memory, where you really do want to kind of go through your flash block sequentially. So a log structured file system makes a bit more sense there. Then the other one that's worth talking about, the guy who really has tried to go out and create a new file system in the form of Riser 4 is out there. It's got a whole lot of interesting ideas in it. It's spent years trying to get into the kernel, and it's still, I don't really see when that might happen. I think the future of Riser 4 is now in serious doubt for reasons I don't think I'll really get into here. Let's just say that unless somebody comes along and adopts it and does a lot with it, that Riser 4 might just fade away. And I think that's actually sad because Hans Riser was trying to do interesting things. He was trying to bring new ideas on how our file systems and how our systems should work. And I'd like to see people doing that. Anyway, if you're interested in file systems, there are a number of talks here on file systems. There's a LogFS talk later on today. Tomorrow, Jen Saxby was talking about CFQ, which is actually below the file system layer, but it should be a very interesting talk, so I put it up there. On Friday, if you're interested in what's really happening and the stuff that you're going to see in the near future on your Linux system, go to Ted's talk on ext4. And then Val Henson is going to be looking at a number of file systems and how you can choose between them also on Friday. Hardware support, moving down the stack. I'll make the claim that Linux hardware support is better than ever. Most hardware just works. There are no driver disks. There are no hassles. You plug it in, it works. Linux really does support more hardware natively right out of the box than any other operating system ever has. But there are a couple of pesky little exceptions there, being primarily wireless networking and video adapters, not limited to that. The biggest problem remains that the vendors of this hardware will not release free drivers, or even better, the programming information we need to create those free drivers ourselves. People ask why. But I cannot improve on this quote from a product manager at NVIDIA, who tells us that it's so hard to write a graphics driver that open sourcing would not help. Over the years, we've managed to build this incredible free system that does things nobody would have ever imagined, but a graphics driver is beyond us. So you can get into the other reasons, but they don't get it remains the highest on my list for why they do this. So in these problematic areas, I'd like to report that wireless, I think, although it has been poorly supported over the years, is getting better. We've had problems with drivers for wireless cards, and the network stack up at the higher levels above the wireless drivers has never been all that great in Linux. John Linville, the guy who maintains this now, told me that in the beginning they really just treated wireless adapters as another kind of Ethernet, but they're not Ethernet, and there are a whole lot of issues that have nothing to do with Ethernet there. So this is all being replaced with a networking stack that came from DeviceScape. It's a company that developed this and then GPL'd it a year or so ago. This is a proper 802.11 networking stack with support for things like software Macs and so on that we don't really have yet. This is making its way towards the main line. It's taking forever. There's been a lot more that needed to be fixed in this code than people had imagined early on. And DeviceScape itself has kind of withdrawn from the process more than people would like. So it's taken a while, but I expect within a year it'll be in there. There are various new drivers, the Broadcom driver I mentioned already. There's an Etheros driver that has been in the BSD systems and OpenBSD for a long time. That driver has been under legal clouds. People have cast allegations on how the reverse engineering was done and whether it could be put into the Linux kernel safely. And people are very nervous about putting possibly tainted code in the kernel for very good reasons. So this code has been kept out, but the Software Freedom Law Center did an investigation. They have pronounced it clean. They have said that it can go forward. So there are people now working on porting this code to the DeviceScape stack. Soon there will be a Theros support in the kernel. And that will be another wide range of Linux users who will have native support. Intel, of course, supports this driver as well already, if you don't mind little user space regulatory daemon that is not free. It's gone. Cool. Glad to hear it. I didn't know that. It's gone. Anyway, the point is that this situation is getting much better, and within a year or so, people will not be complaining about wireless drivers anymore. We're just about done with this one. Video adapters are a little bit tougher. The video vendors remain stubborn, again, with the exception of Intel, which, while being short on programming information, is releasing free drivers, and this is a great thing. Now, if they would release controllers that we could plug into our computers, be even better off. NVIDIA, I mean, we already quoted NVIDIA, but there is a project called Nouveau, which is reverse engineering the NVIDIA adapters. They have been putting some serious energy into this. They're making some real progress on it. There's some ground to cover yet, but they're getting there. This project, I think, is going to succeed, and that is a good thing. ATI, if you have anything up to R300, support is pretty good. Anything newer than that, and it's not. I'm starting to see, actually, some people who are trying to pull together a project to reverse engineer the newer ATI chipsets as well. So that may yet happen. We have the capability to do this if we set our minds to it. So that may yet happen. We'll see, but that will take longer. If you're interested in this stuff, you need to go to David Ehrlich's talk later on today and hear all about it. And just a word on binary-only drivers. Yes, they exist. I don't think I really need to tell this crowd about all the reasons why this is a bad idea, so I don't think I will. Just trust me, we don't want to do it. If we want to keep our free operating system that we have spent all these years building, we cannot accept binary-only proprietary drivers into it. We simply cannot do it. We don't have to do it. Enough said. Okay, moving up the stack again a little bit to networking. There's a lot going on in the networking area. I'm really only going to touch on a couple of them. Network channels were really kind of broken out at this conference 1 year ago when Van Jacobsen presented the idea. Network channels are really just taking as much of the network processing as you can and moving it right to the endpoints, possibly even as far as in the user space, and doing it all in a very cache-friendly way so that you can expedite the processing of packets to the greatest extent possible. You can get some pretty impressive benchmark numbers if you do this right. As soon as you try to intersect it with a kernel that does real things like firewalling and traffic control and policy routing and all that sort of stuff that our kernel does, it becomes very hard to keep all this together. So this is going to be a slow process, but there are people working on it. And we'll see things happening there, I think. The other thing I'm mentioning here, even though it's not strictly networking related, is the K event interface. A number of operating systems have an interface, a single point where you can go and get all the events of interest from the kernel, be it IO events or signals or anything that's going on out there. Linux has never had that. There are performance aspects to that, and it also makes it harder to port applications from certain other operating systems. So people have been working on this. There is a patch adding an interface called K-Events to the kernel in a fairly advanced state. It's out there. There are ongoing disagreements over the API. This is a brand new and very significant user space API going into the kernel. So people really do want to do it right. So there's a lot of talk over this. The developer, I think, is getting a little frustrated with it, but he's going to have to stick with it for a little while yet, I think. But eventually, Linux 2 will have an event interface in it. If you're interested in this stuff, network channels and more, I wouldn't miss David Miller's talk tomorrow morning. Okay, security, very briefly, there's not a whole lot to talk about in security. SDU Linux seems to be sort of solidifying its position as the one true security framework. It's the one that's in the kernel now. Most of the work, I think, with SDU Linux is in user space, just developing management tools that will allow mere mortals to do something with SDU Linux so they don't have to simply turn it off so that they can make their systems work. But there is another framework that's out there. It's called AppArmor. Was GPL'd by Novell, again, a year or so ago, I forget exactly when. AppArmor offers lower capabilities with much simpler administration. For a lot of the things that most administrators want to do, AppArmor is very nice. You just have this very simple little file, and it makes it very clear what you're trying to do. And it avoids a lot of the hassles that come with SE Linux, but it's had a hard time getting into the kernel. The developers don't really like how it was done. So there's been a lot of issues with that. AppArmor has gone fairly quiet in recent times, but I am told there's a release coming sometime fairly soon. So I think we'll see stuff happening with AppArmor again in the near future. There's continuing talk about reworking the security module framework, but that too has gone relatively quiet in recent times, so I don't think I'll get into that much. Instead, move on to the real-time patch set. There is this real-time preemption patch set that people are working on. Claims that with Linux on reasonable hardware, you can get 20 microsecond deterministic response times out of the system, something that people never thought you would be able to get out of general purpose Linux. So much of this has been merged. A few pieces of it remain. We'll see some of this coming in. Dynamic Tick in particular, which is also of interest to the virtualization folks and others, going into the kernel. And if you're more interested in this, Ted will be talking about this later on today. Okay, small systems, very briefly, a lot happening there. I don't think I'll talk much about it because there's not a whole lot to say. If you want to hear about this, you can go to Jim's talk this afternoon. Observant people have noticed this is at the same time as the Nouveau talk and the real-time talk. I want to talk to whoever scheduled that, but so be it. That's the way it is. And then my final topic here is on licensing the GPLv3. Again, I don't really need to get into this. Most of the people have heard the arguments on this already. There's supposed to be a new draft coming, perhaps as early as this week, on this. We'll see what happens there. But the bottom line is that a licensing change for the kernel is very unlikely anytime in the near future. It's hard to see how that could come about. So that's what I had to say. I don't know if we have any time for questions or not.
Not really. We're pretty much ready to move on to the next talk. But I'd just like to thank Jonathan for talking today. Just a small token of appreciation. We've got a couple of little presents for you, Jonathan, which I'm sure you'll find a way to put to some kind of use.
So
they can be filled up later on, have no doubt. So thank you, Jonathan. Our next talk in this theater is going to be Tridge, and he's going to be talking about clustering TDB. So if you'd like to hear about that, that will be on in 1 or 2 minutes once we get set up.